Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And it's summertime, we're enjoying the beautiful, hot, sunny weather. All of the big films are coming out in the cinemas, Jem. We've got, I don't go to the cinema very much, but I'm guessing we've got a great big superhero movie. We got big action effects movies.
Yep, seen some of them. And animated films, seen some of them.
There's kind of a film that's come out this year that's kind of broken the mold a little bit for summer blockbusters.
Yes, and this is the reason why we're actually talking about it today. Don't worry, you haven't tuned into the wrong podcast. We're not suddenly going to review all the summer blockbusters. But slightly incongruously, right in the middle of all this stuff with giant robots, animated little yellow people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we've got Dunkirk.
Oh, when you said a historical movie had come out, I thought we were going to get Braveheart 2. I was ready for that. Braveheart 2 Electric Boogaloo, I think it is.
Controversial choice, to be sure, yeah. Yes, so look, let's be honest. The reason why this is getting a summer release is because of the director, Christopher Nolan. I think he'd be comfortable being called half British, half American. He was certainly raised in the UK, and I've been a huge fan of his ever since Memento. I was one of the people who saw Memento in the cinema and thought, wow, you know, for a low budget kind of indie film, what a brilliant conceit. And it, it just makes you want to, it's one of those films you have to end up watching at home just to sort of say, yeah, so it does all this sort of piece together. Very, very clever. It's his second film. Almost everybody forgets that's Insomnia. Technically, it's a remake of a Scandinavian film set in Alaska, where you've got arguably the last decent Al Pacino performance in a movie. And also that was the year which Robin Williams decided to play two bad guys really well. Insomnia's one hour photos, the other. So once they were announced that he was going to make a Batman film, it's like, okay, well, he's a really good director. I'm not sure what he's going to do with that. And then, of course, he creates the Dark Knight trilogy, which most people would say is the greatest superhero trilogy ever. And while he's in the middle of him making that trilogy, we then got The Prestige, which is also slightly historical. I mean, it's largely based around some fictional characters, although David Bowie turns up being Tesla, which is a little bit odd. Then we've also got Inception, which at the time was a huge, huge hit and everybody adored. And then it kind of got forgotten about. And then there's Interstellar, which there some people like, some people didn't. I would say it's a sort of flawed masterpiece. There's a lot of stuff there to love. And then finally we come to Dunkirk, which is his first proper historical film. And unlike the other movies where people are going, ooh, he loves having secrets around his films. And therefore it's like, well, what's Interstellar about? And, you know, who's the bad guy in Inception and blah, blah, blah. The thing about Dunkirk, of course, is we basically know what happened. Fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. One of the things I think I'm going to touch on there is that when we're talking about the history films, and you mentioned Prestige as a sort of history film, and what I found really interesting...
I would imagine that was exactly your cup of tea, because it was sort of like the early era, or not early, but like the sort of turn of the century sort of magicians, almost contemporary, I guess, with Houdini. And I bet you recognize some of the tricks that Michael Caine was doing. You know, they were probably real things that the Victorians were doing. Is that fair?
Well, this is the thing. He'd thoroughly researched, and sort of there is the... There's the opening moment where they have Chung Ling Su, I think he's supposed to be, I can't remember if they actually used the real name in the movie, the guy that produces he used to produce a full goldfish bowl, and they're sent to, and I know that particular film split a lot of opinion in the magical community, because they did give away tricks, shock horror, they gave away tricks that are well over 100 years old and aren't really being performed these days. But yeah, I think with that one, he did prove that he could play in a historical world, as it were. But with that one, he didn't stay, like you say, purely historical. He did bounce around. He played with science and technology and a bit of almost science fiction as well going on in there. But
oh, yeah, definitely there's some science fiction there. We don't want to say too much. My sister-in-law, before I saw it, managed to spoil the entire movie for me. I was so angry with her. I don't know what kind of people are out there where they're just so... Sorry, nearly called my sister-in-law stupid there. I do apologize. But yeah, the sort of lack of etiquette, if you're going to see a movie like, originally The Sixth Sense or Seven, you know, there are certain movies where clearly the ending is very clever and sort of wraps the whole thing up really nicely. Don't start telling people how good a movie is with the ending. That's just never a good idea. Now, fair enough, you might be able to talk about how in Die Hard, clearly Bruce Willis is going to live. I mean, that's not really much of a spoiler. But when you're talking about a really tricksy film like The Prestige, oh, and isn't it nice to see Hugh Jackman without claws, not being angry all the time, proving that he can actually act. But, you know, when you start dealing with a very tricksy, complex narrative, and again, I guess this is something else that's a departure for Dunkirk, that it isn't a super tricksy timeline with twists and turns. You know, it's the history that's the star of the film, more so than a narrative conceit. But let's not get too hung up on film reviews here.
Yeah, and I think the thing about the move from The Prestige to Dunkirk is The Prestige, it was, for all everything else, it was definitely set in a fictional world. It was definitely, you know, it could be played with. It was kind of the storytelling, the narrative idea of telling it through essentially the readings of two diaries allowed you to fud facts and play games and all sorts. But, Jem, as we both know, historical fiction, when we're actually fictionalizing, as it were, a historical event, we get into muddy waters. Because let's be clear, the Dunkirk film is not Dunkirk the documentary. It is intended as a summer blockbuster, and so it has to have a certain appeal. It's not there just to tell you the history of Dunkirk itself.
Well, you know, it does a pretty good job of that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, when it comes, there is a difference between a movie and a documentary. There's a difference between a history book and a movie. So we have to take that conceit. But a little bit like, I mean, the inevitable comparison will be Saving Private Ryan, a World War II movie where some of the most critical scenes happen on a beach. It's just in Saving Private Ryan, they're arriving on the beach. In Dunkirk, they're leaving on the beach. And in a way, it's it plays well to the modern audience. The thing that sort of intrigues me is that you used to win Victoria Crosses, but with remarkable acts of bravery, which invariably involved killing the bad guys. Whereas recently, the Victoria Crosses that have been awarded have been incredible acts of bravery again, but invariably saving Allied troops, troops in Afghanistan or Iraq. And it's the same thing here with Dunkirk. If this isn't about killing as many Germans as possible, this is the... You know, Dunkirk's a very British thing. You know, we kind of see it as a sort of defensive victory. And the irony is that it was a colossal defeat. The plan was to pin back the German army, sort of like we did in World War One, and it all went to hell in a handbasket. Blitzkrieg completely outpaced the French and British troops. And therefore, we were forced into this utterly humiliating dash across the channel to get our entire army out of being surrounded and put into prisoner of war camps for the entire war. It was a desperate, desperate situation, which we then turned into a kind of a cheeky British victory, which, I guess, vague spoiler alerts, you know, it was the British population. It was the British... The British in their small little boats that save the day rather than the Royal Navy.
And I think the way I usually describe Dunkirk is the ultimate example of a propaganda victory.
Yes.
Which is really
yes.
What it boils down to is there is no way, because obviously if you're in Germany, the report you get of Dunkirk is we pushed the British into the sea. We pushed them out. We got rid of them. They're gone. They've left this island. We didn't have to capture them all because they ran away. We're not spending a great deal of money trying to keep them in prisoner of war camps. No, they've gone. They're on another island. They can't all just walk straight back over here. You know, we've got the coast defended. There was no, you know, we're a, you know, we're a long way off any thoughts of D-Day at that point in time. They think they've got the coast pretty shored up. It seems very unlikely the British are suddenly going to be able to bring all these troops back again at that point in time. And so for the British to be able to look at that very quickly, and I don't know who was in charge of the propaganda machine at that point in time, but the spin that it takes, you know, we look at the spin doctors in the wars and things nowadays, for somebody to immediately come up and get in the papers and everything else, this immediately spin of, look at this, we're the British, we've saved our troops, we've brought them home, massive, massive victory. And it's just like, yeah, what, hold on, this wasn't a victory, this was quite clearly a retreat. Okay, you can call it a tactical retreat, you can call it whatever you want, but we had put ourselves in a situation where we were now had our whole army on the wrong side of the channel to actually fight this war.
Oh, absolutely. The front had collapsed, and this was people trying to get as quickly as possible away from fighting. Now, there's a very good tactical reason for that, and that was the army of 1940 remained the core of the army, the British army, for pretty much the rest of the war. I mean, we are talking about hundreds of thousands of troops here, and that's worth putting it on a scale, you know, when we talk about we've deployed 10,000 men into Afghanistan. You know, that's a drop in the bucket compared to what was happening then. It's also worth remembering, and also in the movie, they don't show Churchill or, you know, the sort of conversations at the cabinet. The action and the story is very much in Dunkirk, and if it does show Britain, it's sort of on the coast, and it's about the little people, not the power players. But it's worth sort of framing this a little bit by saying Winston Churchill had been in power for just over 2 weeks when the sort of the events around Dunkirk were actually happening. I mean, that's that's a terrible legacy to acquire. I mean, you know, you try coming back from that, but he did. And it, you know, there's a little part of me because one of the Tommies that you see things from the sort of the soldier's eye view on a number of occasions. And one of those soldiers, certainly not the biggest role in the movie, is Harry Styles. Now, when everybody heard that Harry Styles was going to be in Dunkirk, it's like, well, that's stunt casting. And I guess it a little bit is, but it's worth remembering that Christopher Nolan's very good at getting great performances out of people, which you don't necessarily expect. When he announced Matthew McConaughey was going to be the central actor, the star of Interstellar, at that time, Matthew McConaughey had done for 10, 15 years rather terrible rom-coms, and he was sort of known as the bod. He was basically a male bimbo. People have forgotten that he could act. Now, actually, by the time Interstellar came out, the McConaissance, as people were calling it, you know, he was in a number of really good movies like Dallas Buyers Club and also the first series of True Detective, which is amazing. All this stuff is very much rated 18 for a reason. So, yeah, if it's not age appropriate, don't seek this stuff out. But if you haven't seen that stuff, do watch it. But by the time Interstellar came out, people were going, oh, you know, he can act. I'm sure this will be good. And he is good in it. The problems with Interstellar aren't with Matthew McConaughey, per se. And the same kind of thing with Harry Styles. He's certainly not the star of the show, but he's a fresh-faced British boy, which is what a lot of the Tommies were. And, you know, there's an interview with him saying, look, we were standing on a windswept beach and, you know, there was a storm on some of the days that they were filming and they didn't stop filming. They just felt that to show how hard and arduous it was for those guys on that beach under enemy fire, that they should kind of go through hell themselves. And in Harry Styles' own words, he goes, when you're standing up to your thighs in freezing cold water from the English Channel, and you got sort of grit being blasted into your eyes from the wind, and then explosions are going off from each side, I didn't feel I had to do a lot of acting. And I would agree with that. I mean, it sounds pretty awful, but then again, the reality was even worse.
Now, I'm pretty sure I'm showing my own ignorance here, but I will be honest, when I heard just about 2 minutes ago that Harry Styles was going to be in the film, I didn't think to myself, this is stunt casting. I thought to myself, A, who is he? And B, who was he in the film? But now I at least know who he was in the film.
So. Yeah, okay, so the thing, yeah, the thing is, yeah, he is not aimed at you and me. But you know what? So One Direction's clearly aimed at the tween market. And that's the market that doesn't really know a lot about World War II. I'm going to sort of step away from the movie for a moment, tell you a little bit about my own private life. So every weekend, I watch a classic movie, age-appropriate, with my boys, because it dawned on me a couple of years ago. It's like, look, I don't buy this stuff about they don't make them like they used to. Actually, there's some brilliant films out there at the moment, and particularly when it comes to children. That's now a defined market, whereas 30, 40 years ago, occasionally children's movies came out, but they tended not to be given a lot of love. But pretty much since Pixar, you've got really great movies which I can sit there and laugh and enjoy, and maybe there's sort of jokes more for sort of like the adults, but the kids enjoy it too as well. But because there's all this great kids films out there right now, these sort of classic movies from the 60s and 70s just don't really get a look in. So with my boys, it turns out both of them are big fans of John Wayne. We've watched The Sands of Iwo Jima, so they understand a little bit about the World War II Pacific campaign, because they've seen Sands of Iwo Jima, which actually has stock footage from the real battle there. Yeah, also things like Zulu, The Longest Day, which of course is to do with D-Day. Let's see, what else? The Battle of Britain, which they didn't want to watch all of, because halfway through things were looking so grim for Britain, they went, but Daddy, we're going to lose. So I was the one who got to tell them, don't worry, keep watching. It has a happy ending. And it does. But it does a very good job of showing how bleak things are. So, you know, they've also seen things like Rocky as well. And it's great to share the movies that I grew up with them. But it does mean that they have a basic grasp. I mean, sometimes it's distorted. Where Eagles Dare, great film. Brilliant film, the Clint Eastwood, Richard Burton movie where they go into the Alps and then shoot lots of Nazis and things blow up all over the place. None of that actually happens. So I do tend to tell the boys at the beginning, this is a made-up one or this is a real one. And particularly something like Longest Day is, by the standards of the day, pretty meticulous in terms of its research. Not perfect, but I would sort of put Dunkirk in that territory, in the sense that clearly the research has been done. Yes, we can start picking to pieces the sort of bits and bobs of what maybe they should have shown or could have shown. The thing that always got me about Dunkirk is we all know that there was a holding action. They had to stave off the Panzer divisions while they were getting the guys onto the ships. And there was always a part of me going, but how did they do that and get everybody off? Because surely some of the guys either had to be left behind or had to run from their positions holding off the Germans into the ships, which is kind of impossible. And actually, the reality of that is there were about 40,000 French soldiers who basically agreed that they would have the perimeter. You know, they were basically fighting for their country, so they would fight until everybody was taken off the beaches, and ultimately they knew that they were going to be surrounded and have to sit in a prisoner of war camp for the rest of the war. That's a pretty brave thing. And that isn't really a thing that's shown much in the Dunkirk movie. But if we're going to concentrate, and I am about to wrap up here, Greg, but the thing I like about Dunkirk is, oh my God, finally there is a modern day World War II film which shows Britain fighting in the war. As great as Saving Private Ryan is, and it's arguably the greatest war film ever, it's from the American point of view, which is correct, because only the Americans would have been on beaches like Omaha and Utah. But the only time they mention the British in the whole movie, it's derogatory. What about Monty? He's overrated. But that might have well have been the point of view of the American troops. So it's like, great, you're going to give no credit whatsoever to the British at all. And I know America's making the money and they make the movies and they can pick the stories. But this is brilliant to finally see Tommies. You know, not just an insignificant background contribution to the war, but a major event around the British Army. And, you know, there were Canadians there too, and Belgians and French as well. But, if we're going to have a bias towards the Brits, it's about time. Going to calm down now. Back over to you, Greg.
Okay, well, how do I dissect that? Well, the first thing I'm going to say
I just dumped stuff on you there.
I mean, when you said that every weekend you watch a classic film with your boys and that, you know, you're going back to the 50s and the 60s and the films like that, I am going to set you homework for them, because I know they've seen my shows. And,
yes.
So I'm going to set you some homework for them from Greg. I want you to get a copy of The Kid with Charlie Chaplin, one of his full-length movies, and watch that with them and see how they take to a bit of Chaplin, one of his best films, I think, and I think one that you all enjoy as well as they would.
That. All right, I'll give that a go. We've been watching some Laurel and Hardy, for example. Okay, The Kid. We'll give it a go.
The Kid. Yeah, give it a go. But back to sort of the Dunkirk side of things. The one thing I want to say is, and you know what, the name of the film has gone completely out of my head. The Benedict Cumberbatch one about Alan Turing.
Oh, The Imitation Game.
The Imitation Game. I think when you say we've not had a film in recent years, I agree on the front line. We've not had a film in recent years that shows the impact of the British in World War II. But I think The Imitation Game was definitely a film that showed, as opposed to a few years before, the Enigma film with, I think, Kate Winslet in it, which yep. kind of made the whole cracking of the Enigma a very American thing, in ways that they weren't involved very much at all. But I do agree with you that it's nice to see a film that does have the British essential characters.
Yeah, that's what I said on the sidelines, in the sense that, yeah, Imitation Game, it's very important that the Enigma code was cracked, but... Yeah, you don't see the fact that the British were fighting, and the British were fighting in World War II. We were fighting way before the Americans turned up, but, you know, instead what we've had is Pearl Harbor, Saving Private Ryan, Band of Brothers. Some of these are amazing, some of these aren't, like Pearl Harbor, but the point is, where the hell are the British in all of this? And, Britain doesn't tend to spend £100 million on a movie, but this is an example where, We're actually seeing, ironically, we're seeing the British retreat, but we're actually frontline troops, as you said. But yes, I interrupted you. Please continue.
That's good. And actually, I'm going to, without wanting to turn this episode entirely into Greg and Jim do the history of film while we're talking about Dunkirk, we've talked a bit about classic films and that. And actually, when you're watching those classic films, it's interesting if you keep an eye on where each one of the films are made, because you'll see the big split. And I think that this actually does tell on what we've just been talking about with the difference between the Imitation Game and the Dunkirk films and your Saving Private Ryans. Goes right back to the origins of the early film world, where in Britain, we started up our movie companies, our first, the beginnings of the film industry, started up in the obvious place, London. That was where everything was happening in Britain. It was also the centre of theatre in Britain. Over in the States, they started up the film industry over in California, where you had long, bright, sunshiny days and lots of open space, whereas their theatre industry was housed right in the centre of New York. And for that reason, ever since the earliest films, the British films have been focused on the acting. They're theatre people that have gone out to turn theatre into films. They've made teleplays. They basically filmed theatre. Whereas over in America, they went off to California. They had all this wide open space, no real theatre people. They decided just to run around shooting guns. And so I think it's not a discrepancy of, you know, when an American sits down to write an American screenplay about the war, I don't think it's a case of they sit down with an American film sensibility. The idea isn't to push the British out of it, it's just they're telling an American story, and so that American story will have a lot of action in it. Whereas the British story, we take a British story, when we write that British story, we write it with a different sensibility. We're more interested in the discussions behind the scenes, I think had this been a completely British-made film, Dunkirk, I think it's quite possible we would have found ourselves with a lot more sitting around in the cabinet war rooms discussing the details of the evacuation, you know, and all of this and the extraction and everything else, rather than as seeing as much of the frontline action from the British as we actually did.
I can sort of confirm that, because the movie that's sort of not being talked about at the moment is Atonement, which came out, I'm going to say, sort of 8-10 years ago, which starred now this is the thing where my brain completely
McAvoy.
Goes. Yeah, James McAvoy. He was the sort of critical guy, and there was like this constantly non-cutaway scene on the beaches of Dunkirk, but and you know, he was a fighter in World War II, But the thing is, though, and you're quite right, it was about the relationship between him and the woman he loved and their sister. And it was about, you know, feelings and acting and all that kind of stuff. And also supported by Dunkirk. Of course, you've got some pretty heavy hitting actors in there, not like Harry Styles, but you've got Kenneth Branagh, Mark Rylance. Both of those are extremely well respected theatre actors. In fact, Mark Rylance has been sort of at the top of British theatre for decades, and yet he's been very, very resistant about doing movies. In fact, sort of, there was this rumour that he'd actually fired one of his agents because they were trying to force him into sort of more movie and TV work than he was comfortable with. But obviously, he's done, you know, he's won an Oscar now doing the Cold War movie, which the name escapes me on that now, right now. But there's also Tom Hardy in it. Not that he's got a particularly big role, but Tom Hardy's cool. And, you know, he's, you know, I'm going to say he's like the British Robert De Niro when Robert De Niro is really exciting. The amount of variety on his CV is pretty amazing. But also, he can do action as well. So, you know, you've got some really heavy hitting actors, which adds some gravitas. I mean, Kenneth Branagh sort of playing the Commander Bolton, he does a really good job, you know, like in the trailers where he does a good job of explaining the situation. So sometimes there's, if you like, history pouring out of his mouth, but also just the idea of the scale of this problem. It was a remarkable problem to solve. How do we ship, you know, more than 300,000 soldiers, you're surrounded by the most technologically advanced army in the world, being constantly attacked by dive bombers? How do we get all those people off that beach? You know, how do we do that and keep most of the army intact? I'm happy for the propaganda to sort of call it, you know, a defensive victory, because it really was a miracle. There was the miracle of the Marne in early World War One, which, you know, that was a pretty impressive moment. And if you're going to call it the miracle of Dunkirk, I think I'm not normally that kind of emotional, but it was weird. And indeed, you know, the debate still rattles on to this day about why didn't Hitler just tell the Panzers to keep going? And there are lots of different views and variations on that. But it's, you know, it was a genuinely remarkable moment. It is very cinematic. And, you know, Christopher Nolan reminds everybody why he's, you know, one of the most exciting directors working at the moment.
And I think there's two things I'm going to wrap up with, because we are rapidly running out of time in this episode. The first one is your mention of Tom Hardy. Now, I must admit, when I did hear that Christopher Nolan was having Tom Hardy in a film again, I did half of me have a little worry that perhaps Bane was going to show up halfway through Dunkirk and start breaking people's backs in a way in which they can heal in 5 minutes laying in a bed. But aside from my little commentary.
Use that voice as well, because, I mean, he has to, you know, he's an RAF pilot, and, you know, he has to sort of put the mask on, so maybe you go, I can't do the voice, but I was attempting to do a Bane voice. But yeah, that would have been an interesting choice. He doesn't make that choice, though.
He did have the mask. He did have a mask on as well. You're quite right. Christopher Nolan does like Tom Hardy in a mask. But back to my original point about propaganda. One of the things that I liked about Dunkirk, and this goes back actually to the first shot in the very first trailer that I saw for the film. They didn't have that opening shot of the first trailer be bombs or guns or running or violence. They started that first trailer with that very, very slow shot of the leaflets being dropped down. The We Surround You leaflets being dropped into the centre of the where the British troops were basically surrounded. And it's another example, I think, of the importance, which Dunkirk gives us as well, the importance of propaganda within wars. The fact that at this point, when the British were surrounded, instead of just immediately pushing home their advantage and shoving all the troops, they took the time to get leaflets created and scatter them over. And for the Germans to do that, to scatter leaflets hoping that it would break the British, and this is a tactic, obviously, that was used right back in the First World War as well, for these tactics to be employed that rely on trying to spook the other side, and for them to think it was worth using that propaganda against the other side before they tried a more violent approach, I think that just shows how careful we have to be always of the use of propaganda, and think about who's spreading what and where and when and why and everything else. And the fact that I think that scene is important, not just within the film and within the history of Dunkirk, but also hopefully will echo to a few people today about just trying to check their sources, the same as we do with all of our history stuff, Jim. Just trying to check your news sources all the time, because let's face it, all news has an element of propaganda.
That's deep. I've got just two very last quick things. First of all, on the topic of propaganda, I always remember my teacher showing me, you know, they go, the assumption is in World War II, we got it right, and you know the Nazis and the Japanese got it wrong all the time. But actually, there's quite a good example of the other way around. Japan attacked northern Australia. They didn't manage to sort of land there or invade Australia, but they did carry out a bombing raid. And the Australian papers wanted to diminish the attack. They didn't want to make out that it had been particularly bad, you know, that they, that the Australian population were safe. So actually, if you look at the reports of the damage, the Japanese one was more accurate than the Australian one, which I found interesting. But, you know, they were lying for a noble reason, let's put it that way. And the last thing I was going to say, just going back to your point about the trailer, I thought you were going to mention the scene where all the men are on the pier and they just hear the noise of a Stuka dive bomber, and you just see them all cowering. There wasn't much else that they could do. There was no cover whatsoever. Really powerful stuff. But I've always found that Stuka dive bomber to be just a brilliant psychological weapon. Not only did it drop bombs, and actually by halfway through the war, It was comparatively slow to other aircraft. Everyone else had caught up, and they were sort of shot out the sky. They just weren't really an effective weapon anymore. But from the Spanish Civil War up to halfway through World War II, those were deliberate noises the Stukas were making. They were fitted with sirens. So as they dive bombed towards the enemy, those sirens would sort of rev up and create that high-pitched noise. And it's terrifying. I've never encountered one. I've never been at the sharp end of a Stuka dive bomber. But in a way, that noise of that howl is so ingrained in all of us. We all know that that's a bomb heading our way. Even though it's a very specific machine from a very specific war, we've all associate that particular siren with the fact that we're about to explode. And they do such a good job of that in the film. It just sends a chill down your spine. And I really would recommend people see it in the cinema. It's one of these films that, yes, it'll be great on TV, but you'll create, just like Saving Private Ryan, sort of the surround sound and the noises going off. You'll sit there almost trembling in the cinema. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And also, thank goodness, something that actually teaches you a little bit of history rather than robots beating each other up. I think we can all agree that that's a worthy amount of 2 hours of your time spent.
I think so. And just my final little point, just because you brought up the noise of the Stukas there, is it still amazes me today, and this has to only come from watching films and also the number of shows I go to. But when I'm standing in a show field, and, you know, there are often little planes flying overhead, but very often a lot of the shows I go to will have some sort of World War II flyby. And you can hear the planes flying over, and you don't always know the exact time. But still, the very second you hear the Merlin engine from a Spitfire, you know what's coming. And it's something that you think way back in the war, you'd hear people talking about recognising every single plane by its sound and its engine and the shape of it just looking up. But the fact that we've not needed to know the difference in sound between these different planes for a long, long time. It's been a long time since I've needed to listen out and know whether a plane is one I have to run from or not, just from the sound of the engine. But the fact that still I know the sound of that Spitfire engine roaring as it's coming overhead and it'll turn and make me look every single time, I think is an incredible, and like you say, the same with the Stuka, it's an incredible testament to, presumably, partly the accuracy of various war films throughout the ages, that they have actually bothered to use the right sounds for these aircraft and everything else. That is my final little point.
I'm sorry, you've triggered me, so maybe no time for a what if or anything like that, but you just triggered me. So I live next to an airbase. They always do, like, they obviously are testing the Spitfires just before they send them out to the air shows. And yes, I recognize that noise. And the pilots are just obviously putting the planes through their paces, and they're just sort of barrel rolling around my house. That is just a wonderful, wonderful thing. But one moment of historical inaccuracy. We've done so much love to Dunkirk. Let's do one bit of historical inaccuracy. And one thing that generally is, you can understand why they did it. Spitfires were made out of metal. The Hurricanes, the Hawker Hurricanes, were actually sort of canvas on a wooden frame. And there were far more of those in 1940 than there were Spitfires. It's just none of them exist nowadays. So they didn't have any physical ones to use. But actually, that's a distorted view of the RAF. And actually, there's a huge debate about the how much the RAF should or could have done during Dunkirk, which we're not going to go into now. But yes, no Hurricanes needed to, lots of Spitfires. That's not what actually would have been in the sky at that moment in time. Done. Over to you, Greg. Let's wrap this up.
Okay, let's wrap this up. Well, we are running rapidly out of time for plugs. So what I will say for plugs is go to condensedhistories.com. If you go to the tour diary there, you can find out where I am over the summer. If you go to the condensedhistories.com/gems page, that's where you'll find links to all of mine and Jem's books, which makes it sound like I've written more than one. Do check those out. Follow the links through. There's loads and loads of books from Jem you can read on there. But we are out of time. So just a massive, massive thank you to all of us for listening. We will try and avoid going off on a film review podcast again next week. But I hope you understand why we've done this one, and we hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you very, very much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And thank you very much to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And goodbye, and take care.